Blog Talk Radio.
In 1639, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlord, they defied the law. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and saw. We come to work the land in covenant, to make the waste ground grow, the thirst divided.
Oh my goodness. I needed a phone call. Get me around. It's Saturday night. It's the abolitionist hour with Carl G. Carl G, are you there?
I'm here. How are you doing, Mike? You sleeping in a roadside park tonight?
What? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Are you sleeping on the side of the highway tonight, or what's your situation there in the middle of Kansas?
I was sleeping on the side of the highway. That's a good way of putting it. Yes, I was. Yeah. Oh man, what a day. Well, you know, I got sort of stuck on 9/11. I mean, everybody's talking about September 11, you know. I mean, I was like, I stayed up. Where were you on September 11th?
I Carl, somebody called me when the first plane hit the tower. I watched the second plane hit the tower, and then I took a nap at 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. In fact, I had to set my alarm clock today. I feel like Rip Van Winkle.
Well, that's sort of the way I was today. I was sort of like, I was arguing with my friends about where I was at 20 years ago. What were you doing 20 years ago?
Well, I had just moved back from Chicago to Kansas City, and had settled in up here on the north side, and had just got my first big screen TV, and of course it was a projector type, so it took a little bit to warm up, you know. And someone called me and was like, turn on the TV. And so it was just, but what was worse than seeing the planes hit the towers was that film that British intelligence made of the Al-Qaeda training. It was like this old Betamax, black and white, and they got the jungle bars. It's you know, these FDR period gymnasium equipment they turned into Al-Qaeda training bases. Do you remember that? They were crawling under a tunnel, and there was the live fire shooting over their heads. And then I'm like, and it was on loop, you know, and it really, I mean, January 6th is the only thing that I can compare to that day, because, you know, this all I saw in the media was this training facility, and it's like, this is the worst propaganda that I've ever seen. And and so I knew it wasn't, you know, I knew it wasn't. And then the TS, of course, then, you know, Project for a New American Century, the Patriot Act, and you know, that's our gospel singer, John Ashcroft. That was, you know, he had been governor of Missouri. He had been state attorney general. And to this day, the houses off campus at KU still have a stencil of John Ashcroft's face on the glass of every window in the common areas. A lot of people don't remember how insane John Ashcroft was. I mean, you think Bin Laden is bad. Bin Laden is like Noam Chomsky compared to, you know. But yeah, so I mean, Christian fundamentalism. I mean, Kansas hasn't even apologized for Brown back yet.
Hasn't apologized. Wait. Hasn't apologized for what?
The Brownback. You know, he's the minister of religion, or the ambassador to religion.
Right, I mean,
that guy was just as loony as anything. You know, I mean, they've all come out of here. I mean, Sitting Bull got a spear in the back in Topeka, 1880.
Yeah, he's back, by the way. Brownback is back.
Well,
he's no longer in Washington, D.C. anymore. Now he is back cutting brush. So Brownback is back. I don't think he had anywhere else to go. Well, he lost 20 years. What? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, he lost his. Wasn't he living in a dorm in D.C. or something there in Ivanwald?
He started out at the C Street, the family, years and years ago. That's years ago. Probably about the time of 9/11. He was, that's where he was, with the family on C Street. You can read the book, The Family by Jeff Charlotte. And it's a great book. And Jeff Charlotte's been on Radio Free Kansas. And, before he became a governor, even before he became governor of Kansas, he was neck deep in the fundamentalist cult, C-U-L-T, cult of fundamentalism. I don't know how you give it a polite name. The guy was crazy. So, but, 20 years ago for me, on 9/11, I was, I don't know how to be polite about this. I was at an abortion clinic. Hello?
Yeah, I was waiting to soak in because I was, you know, I've been reading down what's going on in Texas. And there's a website now, and they've got, like, bounty hunters, for people to turn in people who are getting abortions, for someone who transports somebody.
I was an escort at an abortion clinic in Kansas City excuse me, I was at Lawrence, Kansas. I was like doing security work, helping a helping women come into in and out of an abortion clinic in Lawrence, Kansas on September 11th, 20 years ago. And it was a really strange experience because I remember going out and thinking, wow, what a beautiful day. I mean, the sky was absolutely clear. You could, you know, there's no, I was like, wow, there's no jets out. And I, and inside the, what they call the recovery room, was a room with like a half dozen recliners, and in the corner was this big TV on cable, and on the cable TV, it was a big color TV, and it was nice, and I and there was no one in there really that day, and I went in there, and the news, it was on the news about the second tower being hit. And I remember I was thinking, oh my God. And by that time everybody knew it was the second, it was the second tower, and everybody knew it was, by that time even the news media said, oh no, oh shit. You know, basically this is a, you know, this is not some drunk pilot, you know, flying into one tower, you know, I think that I didn't catch on the first tower. I just kept caught on the second. And I was like, oh, shit, the chickens have come home to roost. I knew by that time that it was a terrorist attack. And it was pretty crazy, man. I mean, people at the clinic were going, said, we're getting out of here. You know, we're going home. It was a very strange day. Yeah, I don't know where you were at, but I saw when I had to go pick my boy up, my son, up at a daycare center in Lawrence, and by the time I had got out of the clinic and went and picked him up, the gas lines, I don't know if you where you were at, but, and listeners, you ought to call in, and tell us what you were doing, what happened to you. But for me, I thought that was a weird American thing, driving out of work and finding all these, I mean, it was like everywhere. People were panicking, buying gasoline. I have never seen anything like that. And for 20 miles, on my way back to the farmhouse where we just moved in. We just moved in about 30 miles north of Lawrence, Kansas, where we're at now. And everywhere, every gas station in Lawrence, Kansas, in Oskaloosa, had lines, long lines of people trying to get gasoline for their cars. And I was really sort of freaked out about that. I was like, why are all these people getting, you know, trying to get gas? What did you see in here, Carl G., on that
day? Well, there were a few gas stations that were already price gouging. And, of course, since then we've seen gas spike up to $4 a gallon, but at the time it was unheard of for someone to just, you know, on a whim start charging $4 a gallon. But, you know, they didn't hit the refineries, they hit a bank building in New York City. And so, you know, it as far as critical infrastructure, yeah, it caused a lot of damage. We've had 1,500 people killed in mine disasters in 1907. So it's not uncommon for Bhopal, India. You know, those people were killed with that pesticide leak. And but I think the 24-hour news cycle really fed into everyone's paranoia, and you know, it just wouldn't stop. I mean, we're seeing that now, where there's still people that don't have internet, and all they have is television. Maybe you know, 10 or 15% of the population still get all their information from cable. So it's kind of a dangerous thing, and I feel the American public fell in hook, line, and sinker, and it's been a disaster, and it was the end of our empire, not because they crashed into a building. It was the end of the empire just because the terrible calculations, or the miscalculations of all this war, and I just saw a list of all the military commanders. You know, now they're with General Dynamics, and you know, all this industry, and they lost this war, and they all lied that it was winning. Yeah, we're winning, and people who don't pay attention to propaganda or they've been talking about, you know, the U.S. slipping into fascism for decades. But, you know, before that, I mean, I missed the cattle mutilation. That was conspiracy theory before 9/11. I don't know if you remember, it was almost a folk tradition. You know, Kentucky devil cats and Wind Walker Ranch and these types of things. And then it's just on steroids. And once we started seeing Al Qaeda propaganda of these guys in makeshift military outfits and AK-47s on the street, I see where this is going. This is, you know, America's suffering from Taliban envy. And there were thousands of people who thought that at the same time, because Taliban envy is in our vernacular. I mean, look at January 6th. These people were pulling out guns. They had explosives. And it was the nation's capital. It wasn't even secured that well. I was very surprised how easy it was for them to break into the windows and things. And of course, you know, not a lot of people died, but you know, a half a dozen people or so died as a result. I mean, some of their own. There was at least one woman trampled trying to make it up the stairs into the Capitol. And
right.
But you know, I also realized, because I was looking at, you know, this is 50 year anniversary of the Attica uprising.
Oh, I forgot that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and so, you know, there's been some really, really good books out recently on that, and there were a lot of gains made for prisoners' rights during the Attica, as a result of the Attica uprising. There's a book coming out about Martin Sostre, who won the right for prisoners to sue the state. And so this is where we began to see black anarchism coming out of the Black Panther Party. Because by 1967, the state was cracking down on the Black Panthers, as well as the anti-war movement. And what we saw was executions of Black Panthers in the Bay Area of Oakland and San Francisco. We saw the San Quentin Six. Fred Hampton was in his early 20s, was killed in his sleep with his wife. And of course, the Weatherman Underground came out of a reaction to the killing of Fred Hampton. And he probably remembers some stories back in the day. He might have even had to represent a few of the underground back then. But, you know, so in comparison, you know, to 9/11, you know, we've consistently seen attacks against our liberties. And but this is like the first time we really started seeing people fall for it and just turning over this lock, stock, and barrel here. Here, have it all. We don't need it. And the breaking up of the anti-war movement by Nixon.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so it's 9/11 is almost like an implosion. The people that wanted very badly to be in charge, and we're hearing about this again where people are running on city councils, or running on school boards again. Well, this is exactly what they did in the 1970s. That's how they, and the joke was is the left took over the English department and the right took over the government. You hear that saying?
No, I admit what the left does what and the right does what.
By the time Bush versus Gore, they really the critics were really the literature departments at most of your universities, and by the time 1994 the Republican Revolution came around, they really started cutting the funds of the English departments in most universities. But they're hardly even recognizable today by what, and even the humanities as a whole has just been gutted. So the idea of citizenship or even any type of participatory government is pretty much gone. I mean, so the prisoners have known this, where we have a generation that is locked up now. And depending on what you call, you know, incarcerated, it could be as many as 7 million people locked up in the U.S. And the rebels are in the prisons. That's pretty much why I feel an Abolition Hour podcast is a good idea, that we start looking at the people whose rights have been stripped and somehow have managed to stay alive, because 5,000 people are still dying a year in prison at the time of the Attica.
I have a brother that just got out and I think you're right about this. This is the unique thing about the Abolitionist Hour. And callers, I see the switchboard is starting to light up. Area code 646-716-8652. If you would like to be on the Abolitionist Hour with Carl G., you need to, when you call in, 646-716-8652, you need to push 1 on your keyboard so it'll let me know you want to come on. I have a couple numbers on right now, but you need to push 1 in order to get on. And we don't do much screening here. Here's one caller right now. I don't know who it is, but hello, welcome with Carl G. on the Abolitionist Hour. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
See, you all took a chance. This is Justice calling in. Hi, Carl. Hello. Happy to be calling in and just kind of hearing the conversation that's happening right now.
Well, it's there's several things that this weekend represents, and we went from 9/11, but we also mentioned the Attica uprising. And the more detailed information about what has been going on, and the numbers, how many of that are actually incarcerated, swayed. I hear anywhere between 2 million to 7 million, and I feel 7 million is probably more like it. What do you think, Justice?
Oh, I definitely think that's more like it. You know, one of our issues is being able to get, you know, correct data and information. And so I think, you know, based on what we know, there's usually more than what we think. And so I think you're right on the mark. Yeah, I know that organizations across the country are uplifting the history of Attica right now. I was on calls this week where I know that that's happening. It's really important, right, that we remember and that we share this information so that people won't forget and so that we have a political analysis behind why it is we're even doing what we do. It's because the history tells us that prisoners have been, you know, treated, you know, horribly in this country, and that some prisoners have been at the center, at the forefront of pushing for better conditions. And also I want to say again that prisoners are workers, right? They are working in those facilities, sometimes providing goods and services that people don't necessarily think about. And so there's a lot to be said about all of this.
And, all right, so the last time we talked, you were mentioning Fayette, Missouri, and I think it's Central Methodist College in that town. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Fayette, Missouri, Fayette, Missouri, some people pronounce it, is a small town, rural Missouri. And, you know, they have targeted black college students there. And, you know, really think about the prison industrial complex. It takes bodies to continue to feed that system. And so black people in particularly being thought of as commodities and looked at as commodities, that's never really changed. And so here we have two students, two black students who are both leaders on the football team receiving scholarships to attend CMU, and they both experience, their roommates, they experience raids. We had talked about the issue with these no-knock raids. We know that these no-knock raids have caused a lot of harm, in particularly in communities of color. But these young people experienced two of these at two different times. And, you know, Christopher was one of these students, was arrested, falsely charged with a crime he didn't commit, placed in jail in Howard County and under a $50,000 cash only bond. And, you know, when I called the jail, I said, you all really want me to bring $50,000 in cash in there? And they said yes. So this is how this little town operates. And, you know, really, really digging in, I noticed that the prosecutor over there really has set everybody's bail pretty high and for cash only. We went to Fayette to fight this thing in June, and Christopher was completely exonerated. The charges that were filed against him, he was facing, what I think it was 15 to 20 years in prison. And it was just completely false. They had made this up. Torrance Evans is the other student who is involved in this. And, you know, I'll tell you what's going on right now. The prosecutor down there is so embarrassed because she knows that they made an egregious mistake twice by doing these illegal raids at these students' homes. But they're unwilling to budge to say, we made a mistake and we want to drop this. They are trying to force the other student to take a plea. And so we found out, I just found out yesterday, he contacted me, and he said, Ms. Justice, I just found out that they've got me on for court on the 14th. And so unbeknownst to him, they moved this for court date for Tuesday. We were expecting to go to say it at the end of the month to fight this. And so, you know, they're doing some maneuvering, right? And sometimes these small towns do because they're used to doing things the way they do them. You know, this shows you how some young person's life can be completely uprooted and down based on a false accusation. And that's exactly what's going on here. A lot more to it, right? Because Howard County used pretrial conditions, meaning they placed a condition on Christopher before they would release him. So although he had not been convicted of a crime, they treated him as if he was. He had to wear an ankle monitor. The other thing to note with that is this is all a racket. He has to pay for that and had to for several months before he was exonerated and proved himself innocent. I'll stop there and let you chime on in, Carl. But I think this shows people how the mass in how mass incarceration grows, how young folks are being just picked off and thrown into a system. And you know, if you're poor and you don't have access to legal help or support, you can get caught up in this system. You know, the public defender's office, my job, I work for the ACLU of Missouri. We sued the public defender's office in Missouri for not providing a zealous defense for their clients, for going in there and just doing a meet and plead on a first time meeting somebody. You know, those public defenders were like, we don't have time. We don't have resources. And so I'm just going to go in there, meet this guy and say, hey, plead to this. You know, I don't care. Well, they care if they're innocent or not, but the way the system is set up, they don't put money, resources behind getting what an attorney might need to prove that their client is innocent. They won't send out for an expert witness, so to speak. They won't send off for that piece of video evidence that would exonerate a person. So you have most people who are held pretrial copping to things they've never done just to get out of that situation. So I wanted to, you know, say that to, you know, kind of highlight what's happening in Fayette, because they expect Torrance, this young black kid, to cop to a plea to something he never did.
And so there's like 17,000 jurisdictions in the United States, which means almost every day there's tens of thousands of young people, black and brown, forced to plea just to get out of jail because they don't have $500 bond. They can't afford $10,000 for a criminal defense attorney. Is that right?
That's absolutely what's happening. That is absolutely what's happening. So, you know, and for poor people, it's really dire, right? So, you know, my organization, we do bailout work. You know, we bail people out of jail. We pay their bond. You know, I've paid a $50,000 cash. As a matter of fact, we just did one a couple of weeks ago in Platte, Missouri. And same thing. I'm like, y'all really want me to bring $50,000 in there cash? And they were like, yes, ma'am, we do. You should have seen the look on their faces when I showed up with it. But it's nobody showing up. if the cavalry isn't coming and you've got no money, no resources, say you're a mama and you're driving around in Kansas City and you got pulled over because your light was out. This is a true story. And you've got kids in the car and they don't care. They take you to jail. And then you sit in there waiting to try to get out. You should have been at work that night. They're expecting you to come in. You work health care, CNA work. You don't go in because you can't because you're locked up. And you spend 3 days in jail before you get out. By the time you're out, you've lost your job. And I'll tell you, if they can't get a full paycheck in, there's no way they can pay the rent. So this happened. Couldn't get a full paycheck in, couldn't pay the rent. Ended up getting kicked out of their spot and sleeping on a friend's sofa. You see the downward spiral that this can have, not to mention still having to appear in court for something, which could interfere with a job that somebody may have. So there's a lot that goes along with this that people don't think about. The other thing is a particular person was able to get somebody to come and get her children. But there are situations where no one is available at the moment, and there you have the opening for another state agency to come in and mess with your life by messing with your child. So there are so many residual effects, implications, and we know that in particularly women are the primary caregivers in their household. They may be the earning money. They may be taking care of older adults, children. And so the loss of, and that's why we bail women out in particularly, because women tend to support men. So we said we'll put our efforts there. But we also bail men out of jail as well. But I think you get a picture of what I'm saying here and how detrimental this is. Carl, you know, just some of the stupidest things. I had bailed a woman out of jail because she got arrested because the grass in her yard was too tall. So these city codes, these city ordinance folks are getting in on some of this. When we were doing our bailouts for Mama's Day, we came across an elderly black woman who had, my goodness, I think it was 15 or 20 city tickets, $500 each. It's maddening what's happening.
And so the state, they don't care if a woman is pregnant. Is that correct? That in our county, Jackson County, which is almost a half a million people in this area, that they will handcuff women to bed when they're giving birth. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're talking about maternal shackling. It's definitely been a problem throughout the country. There have been reproductive justice advocates such as myself and others who have been fighting this. The ACLU of Missouri pushed forward a bill a few years ago to end maternal shackling. We were able to get about half of that done, but the sheriffs were really insistent on wanting to have this power to shackle pregnant women who are in labor. And so we still have the issue in Missouri. It's something that is quite ridiculous. I've talked to lawmakers about this, and they're all astonished when I bring it to their attention and say that they don't believe it's happening until I prove that it is. And it's funny, they all agree that it shouldn't happen, yet when there was an opportunity to make a change on it, they did it. And so, yeah, this is happening in Missouri and other places.
Well, it's amazing. Like, I picked up a docket. We were go into someone's hearing, and there was a list of all the court cases on the dockets that day. And this is, and there was 1,800 cases that judges were looking at just in one day in Kansas City. And that's just a phenomenal. How many courtrooms do we have, or do we have like three or four buildings just to run all these cases, anything from divorce to wrongful death or whatever? Is that right? Because we actually had one flood. Didn't we have a courthouse flood, like three floors or something,
yeah,
2 years
there's
ago?
There's something happening over at City Hall. You know, the building. There's some things happening with the physical structure of the City Hall. I'm not exactly sure about the courthouse, although I do imagine that it is with, what was it, Pendergrass Construction helped to build those buildings. If y'all don't know who Pendergrass was, he was a mob boss. And Kansas City has that unique mob history, right? But that's the reason we don't have local control today, as a matter of fact. So I would imagine, Carl, that there are some issues. But to your point about the number of cases that are pushed through these courts, it's quite ridiculous, quite ridiculous. And there is no time, really, for judges to really be discerning in these cases because of the time. I've sat through plenty of them. I've been sitting through these virtual ones to support folks who are going through our participatory defense program, and I kind of see the way that people are being shuffled through like cattle. And a lot of people have no idea what's happening at their court date. They're lost. They don't know what, even if they have had maybe some meeting with their attorney, things are always changing, and people seem to be out of the loop on a lot of things and feeling very lost within the court system. It's just wholly inadequate.
And, you know, what I've noticed about the Missouri Department of Corrections is they have 31,000 prisoners in the Missouri Department of Corrections, and there's 13,000 employees at the Missouri Department of Corrections. And so, like the campus where the Missouri Department of Corrections is massive, just the employees at the Capitol. But if you go over and look at the Department of Education, it looks it dwarfs the mass incarceration dwarfs the education system, and it's so integrated now. You know, people hear about school to prison pipeline, and we're talking about Pendergrass 70, 80 years earlier, and the fact that Kansas City is the only police department that doesn't have local control, and we it's a historical fact that the mafia ran the police department in the 30s. As a result of this, but it's almost like with Puerto Rico, all goods that go into Puerto Rico are actually changed over to another ship in Jacksonville, Florida. And it to me, it seems like there's this kind of changing of everybody gets paid twice for all police work is what it appears, because we're seeing like $100 million construction on crime labs, and it's not actually for crime in Kansas City. It's just very odd. 27th and Prospect, I think we might have touched on this the last time about the housing around where the 27th, it's up east side.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's the 27th 27th Street that saw that community, that entire community was wiped out to build that thing. And they used eminent domain to take it. Very much, I believe, in the way that they're doing the trailer park to build the jail, right? So eminent domain used to displace this black community. I knew several people who lived in that community. I mean, they had been there for generations. And so they were not happy about having to leave and having to settle for what they felt like was not was inadequate for their property. And so there were a lot of dissatisfied people. The other thing is that they put Leon Jordan's name on that building, which, if folks don't know, Leon Jordan was the first black police officer in Kansas City. But he quit the department because they would not allow him to carry a gun, and they would not allow him to arrest white people. He left. Leon left. Mr. Jordan left Kansas City. He went to Liberia, and he built their fire department there. He came back to Kansas City and got with Bruce Watkins and Lucille Bluford, and they created what's now known as Freedom Inc. And so for me and for many people that I know, it was a sign, actually, of disrespect that people felt like Mr. Jordan would be turning over in his grave to have his name placed on that building. But that's just a little bit of history about that. But yeah, the eminent domain, and Carl, you're right. Because anytime you see more investment in policing, anytime you see more investment in jails and prisons than you do in education, that is a problem. That means that folks have prioritized carceral approaches instead of restorative ones. And we know that prisons, jails, carceral approaches have never solved anything, and they don't keep us safe. That's all under the guise of keeping us safe. We know what keeps us safe, and you know, well-resourced communities are safe. When people have what they need, they are safe. When people are not struggling over food insecurity, when people are not struggling over finances and health care, those are the things that keep people safe. And so we see on one end people, organizers, activists around the country that are really pushing for those things, right, through the Divest Invest movements, through the Breathe Act that's pushed for M4BL. But we see also the other side of folks who are really trying to ramp this up to protect their investments, right, to protect their way of life, to protect their comfortability at the expense of other people and minorities and oppressed people. So that's what we're seeing, and we see the pushback on it everywhere. I know we've been pushing to get resource officers out of schools, because I don't care what you call it, the police is the police, and they do the same thing at the end of the day, and that is to arrest people.
And police have more influence on a child's career path than a teacher does now as a result. Because,
well, police
like
have too much power, right? I mean, yeah. When somebody can, we say that police legally can lie to you, right? And so with that, it's a problem because, you know, police use a lot of trickery to try to extract information. And I always tell people, hey, if you're ever stopped by the cops, don't talk. Don't say anything. Don't try to talk your way out of it. Just be quiet and, you know, let them let you go. You know, am I free to go or am I being detained? If they say, hey, Justice, you're being detained, I'm not going to say crap. I'm just going to be there and let them do their job. I'm not going to do their job for them. 9 times out of 10, cops don't have a thing until you give it to them. And what I mean by that is it doesn't even have to be a thing. But what you say can be twisted in such a way in which it can be used against you. And so, you know, the lawyers at my job will say, keep your mouth shut. And I say the same thing. But, yeah, they're a target because they can lie and they have a lot of power. A police officer's word is usually taken over someone else's, right? Judges usually believe an officer. Sergeants believe they're officers. But oftentimes it's so rotten to the core, right? It's just a bad system. No police officer should be allowed to lie to folks, period. I think that one needs to go.
Yeah. And the prosecutor don't necessarily check the work of a police officer, of their statements. Oftentimes the statements are incorrect that the police officer uses in court. And we have this automated prosecution software that is private property, and we can't see exactly how these charges or the time added to these charges on a conviction, how all that works. Is that right? Because there's a company in St. Louis that does the prosecution software for the Southeast United States. It's one of the top companies in St. Louis. There's only 50 employees. That's covering several states, servicing the court system. And just the automation alone needs to just be pulled out. It just needs to be ripped out because it's just not fair. There's, you know, for a private company to have that kind of privacy when the public doesn't have any protection against the lying cop or crooked judge. And it's by no means it shouldn't be a career path in the further areas of government and elections. I mean, how many I see this all the time when we go to Jefferson City, that all of a sudden some assistant to a state representative will say, I came through the Department of Corrections. And it's like, well, just get back to the Department of Corrections. Go back and be a prison guard.
Okay. No, some people do see it as a stepping stone into further their political careers, you know? So, there's so much to be said. You know, Carl, I could keep talking to you, but there might be somebody else, and I don't want to. I know last time kind of took away time from somebody. I definitely don't want to do that. So I'm happy to continue talking to you, but I'm definitely happy to let somebody else join in.
Okay, we're at 8:01 right now, and so we're probably cut off as far as I can tell. Mike was I think I caught him sleeping. I should have gave him a little bit earlier warning.
Yeah,
Mike, you there?
It's all right. Yeah, it's coming down. And thank you, sister, for calling in. Come back next Saturday. You're more than welcome to come up and tell your friends to come back for the Abolitionist Hour. Thank you, sister, for calling in.
I want to do a poem for one of our unfavored people, who's now the head of the Nixon campaign. He was formerly the attorney general named John Mitchell. Nixon's campaign seems to be out, you know, getting off on a rather hip foot after his trip to China in the name of peace, while they were killing people right across the street, so to speak, in North and South Vietnam. But No Knock, the law in particular, was allegedly legislated for black people rather than, you know, for their destruction. And it means simply that authorities and members of the police force no longer have to knock on your door before entering. They can now knock your door down. It's No Knock. You explained it to me, I must admit, but just for the record, you were talking shit. Long rap about No Knock being legislated for the people you've always hated in this hellhole that we call home. No Knock, the man will say,
to keep that man from beating his wife. No knock, the man will say, to protect people from themselves. No knocking, head rocking, enter shocking, shooting, cussing, killing, crying, lying, and being white. No knock. No knocked on my brother Fred Hampton, bullet holes all over the place. No knocked on my brother Michael Harrison, jammed a shotgun against his skull. For my protection, who's gonna protect me from you? The likes of you, the nerve of you, to talk that shit face to face, your tomato face deadpan, your deadpan deadening another freedom plan. No knocking, head rocking, into shocking, shooting, cussing, killing, crying, lying, and being white. But if you're wise, no knocker, you'll tell your no-knocking lackeys, ha, no knock on my brother's head, no knock on my sister's head, no knock on my brother's head, no knock on my sister's head, and double lock your door, because soon someone may be no-knocking, ha, ha, for you. No knock, to be slipped into John Mitchell's suggestion box.